is that you end up with inappropriate activation of the mucosal immune system. Okay, there, that's fine. Okay. And so I titled the talk Inflammatory Bowel Disease, and I was asked a question a moment ago, but, you know, one could argue that a better name for this topic might be Inflammatory Bowel Diseases, and I'm just trying to make the point that I will essentially limit my talk this afternoon to the most common forms of what we call IBD, which is ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. I will talk a little bit about whether one should really consider this all part of one disease, IBD, with different variations, and in that same context, whether it really is two diseases, that's ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, or whether there's some terminology in the IBD literature as to whether you're a lumper or a splitter, so whether you then define people who have inflammatory Crohn's disease versus fistulizing Crohn's disease versus fibrostenotic Crohn's disease, whether those are actually a spectrum of the same process or whether they may actually be different diseases. But it's worthwhile noting that there are these other colitides. Microscopic colitis, part of that spectrum, also includes collagenous colitis and lymphocytic colitis, diverticular colitis, diversion colitis, which happens in people after they've had basically either an ostomy or have part of their bowel that's not getting normal fecal flow. And those are also within a category of idiopathic processes, the cause of which is not necessarily known, but that's not necessarily what we're going to focus on today. So again, we should be aware that IBD fits into these categories that are, I'll say, not uncommon. They're not particularly prevalent, but they're also not rare. They're diseases that tend to affect younger people, and you can see from this age distribution that's primarily people in their 20s and 30s, fairly equal sexual distribution, gender distribution between men and women. And although this slide, which was from the early data from the 60s and was published in the early 70s, might lead to a belief that the incidence of ulcerative colitis is higher than Crohn's disease, today that's not really true. And we can sort of see an example here, and this actually plays out in almost every industrialized society where IBD tends to take hold, that it seems as though ulcerative colitis peaks about a generation before Crohn's disease, and then for various reasons that we don't know, over the course of the next 20 to 30 years, it seems as though the incidence of the two of them become fairly equal. And one can see that this was essentially an unknown disease in the United States until the 1940s and 50s, that the incidence of ulcerative colitis rose initially, but by the 80s and 90s, certainly by the 90s and through present day, it seems as though the incidence of these entities are fairly similar. Again, if you take a look at the global prevalence of IBD, you'll find that this is a disease that, you know, is more common in some areas than others, certainly North America, Western Europe. You have these, you know, orange areas of intermediate frequency, so South America, Australia, parts of Southeast Asia, and little tiny Israel in here, possibly related to some genetic factors, since we know that there are certain subgroups that have a higher incidence of inflammatory bowel disease, and Ashkenazic Jews are among those. But again, what's interesting in terms of etiology and epidemiology is that this map is almost a mirror image of what a map of infectious diarrhea would look like in a global distribution. So while we mentioned that luminal bacteria have a role, I'll point to some specific bacteria that may play a role, it certainly seems to argue that inflammatory bowel disease is not the cause of a specific infection. And what's also interesting is it pertains to incidents in different, even more common areas, is what's referred to as this north-south gradient. This is an example of the incidence per 100,000 in Northern Europe, in the yellow, some of the Scandinavian countries, compared to Italy and Germany. In the lower part, and this plays out in the United States as well, if you did the same sort of thing looking at the population, especially around the Mayo Clinic in the northern United States compared to certain areas in the south, you'd also find a higher incidence in northern latitudes. And again, whether this plays into bacteria that are more common there, what the bacterial flora of the intestine is at those at those elevations is not quite clear, but it is clear that this north-south gradient exists both in the United States and in Europe. This will get back into that concept of whether, you know, IBD is one category with different with different appearances, or whether these are actually different diseases. So, you know, there are clearly also environmental risk factors for both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, although interestingly they're not the same risk factor for each disease. So, you know, it's been known for a long time that people who are active are less likely to develop ulcerative colitis. People who have ulcerative colitis are less likely to flare while they're smoking, and if they are smokers and they quit, they're more likely to have a flare after they quit. Conversely, smokers are more likely to have flares of Crohn's disease, and some of the medications that are used to treat Crohn's disease work less well in people who are actively smoking. So, I mean, again, each of them are affected by that, and the exact component of cigarette smoke is not clear. People have looked at nicotine patches as a novel therapy for ulcerative colitis with mixed results, but again, so it is clear that both of them have a linkage, although clearly they respond somewhat differently, which lends to the argument that they're not just all part of the spectrum of different manifestations of the same process. The same thing, appendectomy has been shown to actually be somewhat protective in ulcerative colitis. In no way, shape, or form am I recommending prophylactic appendectomy to prevent UC, but for people who've had appendicitis and have subsequently had appendectomy, if you follow them over time, they have a lower incidence than the general population of subsequently developing ulcerative colitis, but no impact on the risk of Crohn's disease. And then some of these other things, I think that if I made mention to the fact that this is a disease that's more common in industrialized societies, those that have, modern plumbing per se, it does seem clear that, higher sanitation level in childhood, which maybe has to do with adapting to certain antigens, etc., but that seems to be more closely linked to Crohn's disease. And then some of these other things on the list that really seem to have a much weaker association with either UC or Crohn's. So I usually like to make the point, each time I give this lecture, that, in spite of the fact that I'm a gastroenterologist, and I'd like to think that the GI tract is the most intelligent organ, in the body, that at the end of the day, there is a limited number of ways that the GI tract can respond to injury, and inflammation is one of them, and colitis is a generic term. All it means is inflammation of the colon. So one should bear in mind that there are obviously different ways that one can get to that. So we're talking primarily about ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, but radiation exposure, ischemic injury, infectious injury, antibiotic injury, and some of these can clearly lead to different patterns that may be appreciable either on endoscopy or on biopsy. But just bear in mind that colitis in and of itself is a generic term, and when you see a CAT scan report that talks about rectosigmoid thickening suggestive of colitis, that doesn't suggest anything in terms of an etiology. So we'll talk a little bit about the manifestations in such a ulcerative colitis. So the thing to bear in mind is that it's a disease that almost always starts at the rectum, will be fairly homogeneous in terms of its involvement of the, in terms of its circumferential involvement. It'll have a continuous distribution. It's confined to the mucosa only. And as we discuss Crohn's, that'll explain some of the differences in manifestation of those two entities. But usually it starts at the rectum, proceeds to a point, and then stops. And it's, as opposed to other entities, it's far less likely to have skip areas, etc., and only involves the colon. And we sort of define the extent of, we sort of define ulcerative colitis based on the severity of the inflammation and the extent of the inflammation. So the extent is determined by how much of the colon is involved. Rectum only is proctitis. Obviously, rectum and sigmoid proctosigmoiditis, and different distributions depending on how much colon is involved. And here's a nice example. This is a colectomy specimen laid out in the same way as the other one. So the colon's removed. It's open and laid flat on the table. And you can sort of see this is rectum, all involved, nice continuous distribution. And then you can almost draw a straight line at the point where the inflammation stops. And so this would fit that category of extensive ulcerative colitis. Obviously, this is someone who ended up getting a colectomy for reasons that, I assume due to fulminant disease. But again, a nice illustration of the classic appearance of UC. And again, this is sort of the spectrum of what inflammation could look like. So if you have the opportunity to see routine colonoscopy, you appreciate the fact that this is a colon because these are not circumferential folds, these are haustrae. And I'll show you an example later on of valvulae, which are the folds in the small intestine. And you can sort of make out the nice pale mucosa and the submucosal vessels running underneath. And then, as we come over here, this area here, except for a little bit of color due to the way that the image presents, is not a whole lot different, but you can sort of make out these sort of white areas, which is the way that light gets scattered in a setting of both edema and inflammation. So, this would be mild colitis. Here you can see it's almost hard to recognize any normal mucosa. A lot of the scattering of light, these white areas that are erosions, and then in the case of severe colitis, you end up with all of this white exudate ulcer. And although sometimes this can heal and look almost normal after it heals, in other occasions, let me just go up one picture where, you know, when we talk about what burnt out or quiescent colitis looks like, so here you can sort of see these nice vessels, they're sort of straight, they're branching, there seems to be some purpose to the way these are going, almost like tributaries off of a river. Whereas, you know, here you get these ectatic looking circular blood vessels, and this is a small growth which is called a pseudopolyp, which is a common finding in quiescent colitis, which really has to do just with a healing and repair mechanism. In most cases, when you see a polyp like that, that's actually the more normal mucosa. Everything else has sort of been denuded and effaced, and what you end up with is some hypertrophic or hyperplastic mucosa, whatever it means. Again, I use the term that colitis is really a generic term, and so this is a histologic example of what would be referred to as an acute colitis. And so the things to bear in mind also, when you sometimes see patients as outpatients, where you have someone who's had a procedure as an inpatient and you see a pathology report, you'll often see words like cryptitis and crypt abscesses. And I think that a lot of physicians, including some gastroenterologists, in their minds seem to equate that with inflammatory bowel disease. And I just want to make the point that, you know, these are normal, you know, linear crypts. Cryptitis is basically finding, you know, polys eating away at the base of the crypt, and I think there are a couple over here. And a crypt abscess is basically when you sort of have inflammatory debris and leukocytes, you know, and neutrophils taking up the base of the crypt. And basically it's a non-specific term that doesn't define etiology. And so as a gastroenterologist and someone with an interest in inflammatory bowel disease, I'm far more interested in a description of what's referred to as crypt distortion or altered crypt architecture. And so as opposed to those nice linear straight crypts that we saw in what's basically an acute infectious colitis, when we see this branching, and some of this irregular thing in the next slide shows it to you side by side. So this again is a nice linear array, and here you can sort of see there's more purplish, there's this, the nuclei are a little bit larger, this is more irregular, and so these are the types of things that we see related to chronic change. And so when I made that joke before about the limited ways that things can respond to injury, but when you're talking about constant injury and repair, this crypt distortion is a more of a hallmark of what we see in people who have inflammatory bowel disease. Again, that's not specific for Crohn's versus UC. That can be seen in either. And occasionally can be seen in other forms of chronic colitis, such as in some cases of ischemia, if that goes on to become a chronic process. And I guess theoretically in some cases of diversion colitis as well. So again, this is the same slide I showed before, but just to compare and contrast some of the things we talked about in ulcerative colitis with the distribution of Crohn's disease. And, you know, so classically, you will hear that Crohn's disease can occur anywhere from mouth to anus is the way that, you know, most textbooks introduce the topic. That said, the overwhelming majority of patients who have Crohn's disease have involvement of their distal small bowel and or their colon. So you'll basically find that about 45-50% of patients will have involvement of distal ileum as well as colon, maybe 20% have colon alone. About a third have small bowel alone, and although there may be, you know, cases and you may encounter patients with description of gastric or esophageal Crohn's, it is extraordinarily unlikely to diagnose somebody with upper GI Crohn's disease in the absence of ileal or colonic Crohn's disease. So, you know, as far as we're concerned, if somebody's had an evaluation of their lower tract and hasn't, you know, had that diagnosis made, it would be an almost reportable case to evaluate them or to do further testing looking for esophageal or gastric. And if you were to find an entity in the upper tract that seemed consistent with Crohn's disease, it would be appropriate to evaluate their small bowel and their colon to see if they have evidence of it there. And as opposed to what I describe with ulcerative colitis being a disease of the mucosa only, So this is the colonic mucosa, this is the basement membrane, and so the disease in ulcerative colitis is basically confined up until this level, which is why predominantly what you end up with is diarrhea, bleeding, but not necessarily some of the manifestations that we see in Crohn's disease. It's far less in patients with ulcerative colitis. It's far less likely to see, it's not highly unusual to see fistulization, which we'll talk about. And some of the things that really differentiate or the hallmarks of Crohn's disease have to do with the consequences of having this full wall thickness inflammation and how that affects surrounding tissue and surrounding organs. So some of the things that are clinical features or distinguishing features that we see in Crohn's disease and differentiated from ulcerative colitis are related to this transmural involvement. So some of the things that I'll point out first, those that are related to the transmural involvement. So stricturing is something which is fairly common in Crohn's disease. A stricture in ulcerative colitis should be considered a cancer until proven otherwise. Because of the fact that it usually doesn't affect full wall thickness, it's very unusual to develop stricturing in ulcerative colitis. The same thing being said about fistulization. Fistula arise from full wall thickness, an area of bowel abutting something else, and basically eroding or having inflammatory planes come through. So that's another, one of those distinguishing features. Outside of that, rectal sparing is something that's fairly common in Crohn's disease, which is not part of the normal consequences of ulcerative colitis. Whereas almost everybody with ulcerative colitis will present with bleeding, up to 30% of patients with colitis, and the majority of patients with only small bowel involvement, often present with outgrowth bleeding in Crohn's disease. Small bowel involvement and more proximal involvement certainly happens in Crohn's and not even you see these skip lesions as opposed to continuous distribution. So again, I think that for decades we often discussed inflammatory bowel disease as one group of diseases because their treatments are somewhat similar. Again, not as similar as they used to be. Some of the risk factors and susceptibilities seem to be similar, but I think it is clear over the last maybe 15, 20 years that there really are somewhat different consequences and even different familial patterns of both ulcerative colitis and even the different forms of Crohn's disease. Again, the 20 to 30% refer to those people who have colon involvement and don't bleed. And then there's another subgroup that has small bowel involvement alone that rarely bleed. Right, but whereas the overwhelming majority of patients with ulcerative colitis is well over 90%. Part of the spectrum of their disease. Well, one of the is that they will always they essentially always have bleeding with their diarrhea. Okay? Again, just to give you some concept of sort of the spectrum of disease that you can see both endoscopically and radiographically. So I mentioned, so these now are circular folds of the valvulate conodenti that you see in small bowel, and these are sort of nice little punched out aphthous ulcerations that are probably the most mildest form of what we see in Crohn's disease. These are both small bowel resections, but just to give you an idea again, so once again we have two, these are separate segments of small bowel, each of them removed, cut open, and laid on the table. And in this one you can sort of see fairly normal appearing folds, again these valvulae here, until you come down to this segment here where you can see this redness, this, you'll have to appreciate, I think you can, that it's somewhat thickened, that the light is scattering a little bit differently than it is up here because of some of the edema. And also that it's harder to get this to lay flat like a piece of paper down here as it does up here because of some of the wall thickening. And to an even greater extent, this one's almost tubular. You have to have a clamp and hold it down to actually get it to lay out. And you have wall thickness that basically goes from here to here, and over here it goes from here to here, again, because of this transmural circumferential involvement, which is much more dramatic than we're seeing here. And then I actually took out this slide that I used to have, and you'll see in descriptions, especially of the radiology of Crohn's disease, this description of a cobblestone pattern, right? It's actually a term that's often described on a small bowel series, but it's related to the fact that there's this classic X-ray appearance that, and sometimes a histologic appearance that's called cobblestoning. And the reason that evolves is that the normal folds of the small bowel are circumferential, and usually the ulcerations that you get in Crohn's disease are linear. And so it almost has like the circumferential fold, and you're blocking it up with these linear ulcers. And so it looks like bricks on a walk in terms of, circular folds and longitudinal ulcers that then scar. And so this is not as long as some, but that's a fairly classic appearance of an ulcer in Crohn's disease. I alluded to this before. So not only do we know that there are different manifestations of Crohn's disease, but it does seem more often than not that when one when an individual has Crohn's disease, they tend to fit into one of these patterns, and that when Crohn's disease runs in families, it tends to be that the pattern that runs in the family stays in the family and it doesn't really cross over. And some of this is borne out by the genetics, it's certainly borne out by some family studies. But so when we talk about different forms, clearly we talk about people who have an inflammatory form, who tend to have diarrhea, weight loss, a lot of signs of sort of, let's say, a hypermetabolic situation. So they often, will have some, not necessarily protein wasting, but it's harder for them to gain weight, and usually because of this chronic inflammatory status. Whereas people with a fibrostenotic pattern will tend to get more postprandial bloating, fullness, discomfort, borborygmi, which is sort of like a lot of bubbling and gurgling, related more to partial obstruction. And it's important over time, not necessarily on day one, but to differentiate these patterns. Because whereas there are a lot of medications that may help treat inflammation, there's really nothing that treats fibrosis. And one thing, that, in case I don't get back to it later, but a point I always feel is important to make in this type of a talk, is that there are a lot of people who are taught through the years that, surgery and ulcerative colitis is curative, because it's a disease that only affects the colon. You remove the colon, you remove the disease. Whereas surgery in Crohn's disease should be avoided because it can recur in a majority of patients. It can occur anywhere, again, from mouth to anus, and that really, even if you remove it, you can't cure it. And while it's true that even if you remove it, you can't cure it, if you have a patient who's got fibrostenotic disease and has a fairly short segment with a tight stricture, no medication around will undo the tightness of that stricture. And I've seen too many patients through the years who are basically not advised to have surgery or discouraged from having surgery because it, quote unquote, can't be cured, where, a fairly limited ileocecal resection would remove the disease segment, prevent that, and allow them to sort of start the clock over, with a lot fewer symptoms. So, again, it's an adage that I don't think it's as popular as it used to be to sort of say you never operate in Crohn's, but I think that an appropriately timed operation is an important thing to consider in a correct subset of Crohn's disease patients. And one of the most horrible consequences of Crohn's disease are people who have a pattern more for fistulization, and in this case you're looking at just a short segment of small bowel that's involved, and that usually doesn't cause much in the way of symptoms. But bear in mind that people can fistulize through their abdominal wall, through cutaneous tissue, into the bladder, into the vagina, into the rectum, and obviously some of those can be very disfiguring, very embarrassing, and extraordinarily uncomfortable. So again, some of this I already alluded to. So the most common clinical pattern that you see in people is inflammatory or pain, tenderness, diarrhea, weight loss, and again, some often anorexia just related to the chronic inflammatory condition. Whereas in people who have an obstructive pattern, you'll often find postprandial discomfort, distension, and some have vomiting, but many of them just know that when they eat, they don't feel well. And so it is really more of this food avoidance, that they're losing weight because they know that whenever they eat, they consciously or subconsciously get sort of full, distended, uncomfortable, and so they just tend to start eating less. And again, this is sort of a radiographic experience. So this is distal ileum, terminal ileum coming into cecum, same thing over here. And just an example of two conditions, this is what's classically referred to as a string sign, often, again, sometimes related to inflammation, but often sometimes related to stricturing. And when you see something like this, there may be a role to giving a trial of medication for a few weeks or a month or so to see if the symptoms will improve and this will open up. But if this is related to scarring, this would be an ideal person. Just remove from there to there, they'll never miss it. And certainly they would do a lot better long term. And at least from a radiographic standpoint, this is probably a reasonable representation of cobblestone, where you sort of have like this circular thing. But normally this should be nice and smooth, the same as you see the barium filling here. And here you can see all these defects, which are related to erosions and ulcerations. And again, I mentioned fistulization in general, but the classic symptom in between their bowel and bladder is a symptom called pneumatoria. So you ask patients, do you ever feel like you're passing bubbles or air when you urinate? Do you ever see particles or pieces come out? And that's certainly A significant manifestation of Crohn's disease can sometimes also be seen in diverticulitis, and occasionally with a neoplasm causing that. The classic psoas sign of people who have sort of pain back to their hip and back, for erector paraphernal abscess, which is not that unusual, enterocutaneous, which often come through the site of the scar. So if you've had an appendectomy or other abdominal surgery, that would be the most common place. Again, rectovaginal, which obviously can be very difficult to treat and very debilitating. And I just, the only point I want to make about perianal fistula is that whereas many of these others actually involve bowel, which is inflamed, adherent to another area and sort of eroding through, the pathophysiology of perianal fistula is somewhat different in that you don't necessarily need to have inflamed bowel in the area. You just sort of get some stagnation and infection through these things that are referred to as the crypsum morgagni down in the distal rectum, and you can end up with a localized abscess or fistula around the anus. Again, something which in many cases will help differentiate Crohn's disease from other causes of colitis. So again, I'm not quite sure why I haven't taken this slide out, but I guess, sometimes you see a patient with acute onset, abdominal pain, diarrhea, you try and ask yourself, is this self-limited infectious? Is this potentially inflammatory bowel disease? Clearly a more acute onset of symptoms, with an abrupt onset, shorter duration, often argues for an acute infectious. You normally don't have any chronic inflammatory signs, and the biopsies are more likely to show you those crypt abscesses and cryptitis that I showed you before, whereas people with inflammatory bowel disease usually don't have an onset like that. It's usually a little bit more insidious, developing on over days or maybe a week or so. They tend to get thrombocytosis, which is an acute inflammatory marker. They tend to have, again, sometimes they have an anemia of chronic disease, depending on how long the symptoms have been going on before diagnosis. So they may have a lower hematocrit. But to me, the biggest issue is really this abnormal crypt architecture and the setting of a colitis, which really helps to identify this as more likely inflammatory bowel disease. And again, so this is, I think, one last summary slide of differentiating, UC, which affects the rectum, can involve any role of the colon, but is only mucosal, as opposed to Crohn's disease, which can have scabrias, can be patchy, but is really this transmural inflammation. Okay, I'll sit back down. But so then the question that I'll address on this slide is differentiating Crohn's disease from ulcerative colitis, but I will make the point that it's sometimes far more difficult to differentiate IBD from non-IBD than it is to differentiate Crohn's disease from ulcerative colitis. And the reasons, as we said, we mentioned that about 20% of Crohn's patients have colon alone, which means 80% have small bowel involvement. So if you're pretty certain somebody has inflammatory bowel disease and they have small bowel involvement, they don't have ulcerative colitis. Ulcerative colitis is continuous and starts at the rectum. People with Crohn's disease can often have rectal sparing. If they have rectal sparing, they don't have ulcerative colitis. Patients with ulcerative colitis will bleed. If they're not bleeding, it's unlikely to be ulcerative colitis. Same thing with perianal disease and some of these other things we mentioned. I actually didn't even mention granulomata, but I think granuloma are thought to be almost pathognomonic for Crohn's disease, and I think that's true. I think the reason that we don't rely on that is that while any textbook that you read will tell you that about 50% of patients with Crohn's disease have evidence of granuloma on biopsy, those are usually biopsies of surgical resections. And if you take a look at data on biopsies, of endoscopic biopsies, it's probably closer to 10%. So if they're there, it's helpful. If they're not there, it certainly doesn't exclude it. And again, this is something that I'll just sort of mention that you guys may or may not have seen. We've had a little bit more success with the head of the lab of ordering IBD serologies. And once again, I think that this is something that we've been looking for more and more in trying to differentiate IBD from non-IBD, especially people. I know there was a gentleman in the hospital last month, I believe, who had these diffuse abdominal wall abscesses, who also seemed to have some thickened small bowel. And we were really looking for the serologies to see if we can find evidence of Crohn's disease, which is what we thought he had, not really to differentiate UC from Crohn's, but to see if it would be compatible with Crohn's disease so that we could treat him with, again, the difference is if you're having perforation and abscesses in a non-IBD patient, you would never consider using, immune modulators and medications that had significant impact on immune function, whereas if patients have Crohn's disease, that's certainly among the spectrum of medications that we would use. So the thing to bear in mind is that, you know, these are yes and no ready for prime time. The point being that there are certain antibodies, one might even refer to them as autoantibodies, that are not they're not pathogenic, they don't cause the disease, but they're markers for the disease, and so that we know that a specific type of neutrophil cytoplasmic antibody called a P-ANCA, which is not the same ANCA that you measure in Wegener's, but is positive in about 60 to 70% of UC patients, about 15 to 20% of Crohn's patients, and less than 5% of a general, quote-unquote, normal population. And then there's another antibody directed at a common yeast called anti-Saccharomyces cerevisiae antibody, which is present, again, less than 5% of controls, less than 5% of UC, and up to 50% of Crohn's patients. So if you have a patient that you think may have IBD versus something else, and you have a positive serology, it can certainly be useful to helping you feel more strongly about that conversation. The point that I'll spend 30 to 40 seconds on about this one, it says it hasn't solved the problem of indeterminate colitis, is that occasionally you will have a patient that it will be difficult to differentiate whether they have Crohn's or UC. And I will sort of give you an example. If you had a patient who had disease that started at the rectum, went continuous up to a point and stopped, they presented with abdominal discomfort, bloody diarrhea, you evaluated their small bowel and they had no evidence of small bowel disease, you know, but when you did biopsies, there was evidence of granulomata, right? That's a patient who we would define that person as having Crohn's colitis. And the only reason we would make that diagnosis with any certainty is the presence of the granulomata. So, for lack of a better term, genotypically, they probably have Crohn's disease. Phenotypically, if I showed you their pictures of their colon, their clinical presentation, it looks for all the world as though they have ulcerative colitis. If you were to do serologies on that patient, they would more likely be ANCA positive and ASCA negative because these serologies tend to follow the phenotypic expression of whatever their syndrome is. So people who tend to have colitis only more likely have the antibody profile of people who have UC, even if they happen to have Crohn's colitis. So that's why if you really have somebody and you're saying, boy, you know, I think they have UC, but you know, but they don't bleed, or you know, there's something about this that seems a little bit bizarre, in that setting, these are unlikely to help you. But in the setting of somebody who's having, you know, on and off bloody diarrhea, it doesn't really seem like UC, but you know, but you're wondering, could it be some bizarre infection? You know, and you can't isolate an infection, it may be useful. Certainly in a handful of Crohn's patients who've had small bowel processes and very little colonic involvement, that we've been trying to figure out, is this something, and again, I had a patient a number of years ago that I remember very, very well, but she'd come back from the Dominican Republic. She'd had a lot of antibiotics, plastic surgery there. She had a positive amoebic serology. She, at some point, had, can't remember I think that there was CMV on her biopsies as well. And before I really felt confident giving her medications like azathioprine and anti-TNF inhibitors, I was very much reassured by having serologies that were consistent with Crohn's disease, which is what I really thought was the underlying disease. And she did remarkably well, you know, once we were able to treat her. And so in those unusual cases, and if you nodded, I think the man's initials were VW, but I won't mention his name, but there was somebody in the hospital with a somewhat similar thing and a lot of small bowel disease who the serologies were also very helpful in. Again, just bear in mind, because you'll see it's the type of thing they like to ask board questions on, but you tend to have these extra intestinal manifestations of inflammatory bowel disease. The things to bear in mind is that they can happen in both patients with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, but they tend to happen more likely in people who are actually having colitis and flares of their colitic symptoms, so it's less likely in people who have disease limited to their small bowel and Crohn's disease. Again, some of them affect the joints, some of them affect skin, eyes, oral lesions, and I'll give you some examples of each. Also worthwhile knowing that some of them tend to parallel disease activity. So as an example, this peripheral arthritis, which tends to occur in single joints, usually in seronegative, so we'll be checking, you know, rheumatoid factor and ANA, etc., doesn't cause joint destruction, but this is usually active when people are having flares of their disease, as opposed to the ankylosing spondylitis, and again, it doesn't project all that well, but if I can ask you to imagine, it's probably more easy to see here, the sort of band connecting the these two vertebrae you see here as well. Anybody know what HLA type this is? Yeah, so HLA-B27 is the risk factor for this, and for many of the extraintestinal manifestations that do not parallel disease activity, it seems as though they have a link to HLA-B27. And what's useful to know about some of these is not only don't they parallel disease activity, but even after removal of the colon, and these staples are actually from a colectomy in the patient with ulcerative colitis, but you can go on and have these manifestations even after colectomy in patients with ulcerative colitis. Again, some of the... anybody know what this is on the left? That's what this is. And this is... Okay, so enodosum, again, painful red blotches, usually that don't cause, you know, ulceration or weeping or open areas, can parallel disease activity in either ulcerative colitis or Crohn's colitis. Pyoderma is a bit of an exception to the rule in that about 50% of the time that people have pyoderma will parallel disease activity, about 50% will be independent of it. But clearly, it's one of those manifestations that could be very difficult to treat that doesn't have to be along with active inflammatory bowel disease. Again, the bottom left is episcleritis. Upper right is anterior uveitis. The only way I remember which is that this is the one that parallels disease activity. So it's red, it's inflamed, it's raw. So, you know, that's the one that tends to go along, you know, when people are having activity. And this tends to be more like a real bad pink eye with weeping and itching and whatever, whereas the anterior uveitis tends to be a painful condition. So beware the IBD patient with a, you know, with a painful red eye. And this one does not necessarily parallel disease activity. Just a couple of words about colorectal cancer. Most of you, I believe, know that patients with long-standing inflammatory bowel disease have a higher risk of dysplasia and then cancer. Therefore, there is a recommendation to do routine colonoscopies with biopsies after a duration of disease ranging of around 10 to 15 years. You sort of see that risk goes up about 0.5% per year. So, you know, if it starts rising after about 10 years, you know, by 30 years, there's almost a 15 to 20% risk of colon cancer. For years, I think that there was a debate. I think there was a debate as to whether that was really true in Crohn's colitis as well. And I think that there's been enough data through the years that supports that while, you know, you don't normally get as much surface area at risk with Crohn's colitis as ulcerative colitis because of the fact that there are skip areas. It doesn't necessarily involve the majority of the colon, but that for a similar duration and extent of Crohn's colitis, the risk is similar for both. So, you know, I think I like the recommendation that was made in an article because this is still controversial among some people who fashion themselves as IBDologists. And I think many of us adopt, you know, every year. Some people adopt every other year for surveillance. The data is there but not wonderful. But I think the general recommendation is that rational people might disagree about what the optimal surveillance protocol should be in people with long-standing ulcerative colitis of the colon, but whatever you adopt for UC, you should adopt for Crohn's as well. And I'll just go back just for 1 second to this slide just to point out that this is a little bit different than sporadic colon cancer that we see in the general population. For one, as opposed to more larger growths or polyps that can infiltrate submucosally and infiltrate broadly, you can have multiple locations as opposed to sporadic colon cancer where that's very unusual. It tends to occur at younger ages, probably having more to do with the fact that, you know, this is a disease of people in their 20s and 30s. They've had the disease for 20 years by the time they're in their, you know, 30s or 40s. So it's probably not the younger age in and of itself as a risk factor. It's probably more that they've been living with the risk factor for a longer amount of time. And obviously, if it's hard to control the underlying disease, it can be difficult to differentiate reactive atypia from an actual area of dysplasia. Okay. So, as I said, I'm not leaving much time for therapy, but I have left enough time to go through some of the pathogenesis. So, you know, as I said early on, the next slide will be that second slide that I showed you, but, you know, IBD is sort of the common endpoint of people who have certain environmental risks, genetic risks, and, you know, clearly needs to occur in the setting of luminal antigens, usually luminal bacteria, and which bacteria occur may also have something to do with how one interplays with their environment and why it is that we see these differences in occurrence both in a global distribution but even in countries where it's more prevalent, where I pointed out that north-south gradient. Okay, so just to define you know, one term in particular, so, you know, clearly what we're talking about is inappropriate activation or dysregulation of the mucosal immune system. So, you know, I for those of you that are, you know, aware of the term of oral tolerance, which is probably something that you were exposed to in immunology lecture at some point in the past, but bear in mind that if the role of the immune system is to recognize foreign antigen and react to it, you know, as opposed to, let's say, your lungs that often, you know, you get a virus and suddenly that causes a reaction and, you know, you respond to that inflammatory response with a cough, congestion, runny nose, the bowel is always exposed to non-self. And so therefore, the normal tone of inflammation in the gastrointestinal tract is actually one of suppression. And you can think of it from a certain way that it's almost more miraculous, for lack of a better word, that more of us don't have quote-unquote inflammatory bowel disease. Right? In general, we're exposed to antigen the whole time. We need to try to find a way to have a controlled response so that, you know, we don't get infected or affected by antigen that can cause us harm, but without overdoing that, which leads to a process like what we see in inflammatory bowel disease. And so, you know, there, like with many other things, when there are many etiologic hypotheses, it means we really don't know. But, you know, I think that a number of concepts have been thought about through the years, and there's probably some element or interplay of some of these. So the concept of a persistent infection or a specific infection is one that's long been considered, especially in Crohn's disease, because, again, you have these granulomata. That's not a typical inflammatory response. You know, people certainly think of tuberculosis as a disease that presents with granulomata. Intestinal TB, while fairly uncommon in the United States, is much more common in the Southeast Asia area of the world. And you know, there, if you saw somebody with a granulomatous reaction and ileocecal, you know, inflammation, that would be far more common than Crohn's disease. But what's also interesting is that there is a specific mycobacteria called Mycobacteria paratuberculosis, which causes a infectious granulomatous enterocolitis in cattle and sheep. And so for years, people thought slash assumed that Crohn's disease was a similar type process in humans, and in spite of improved assays, lots of time studying, no one's ever been able to document that infection or any other infection as a specific cause of inflammatory bowel disease. This concept that I alluded to before, but this dysbiosis, you know, nowadays you can't open a medical journal without seeing ads, and even, you know, like Newsweek or Time magazine, without seeing ads for probiotics. And this whole thing about, you know, luminal flora that will help to down-regulate the normal inflammation. But there is some, at least theory, to this concept of having, you know, an aggressive population of pro-inflammatory bacteria in your bowel, which then tend to target and activate a different set of cytokines than these other things that may actually decrease inflammation. I'm going to spend a bit of time describing, you know, some of the concepts of defective mucosal integrity to point out how it is that the bowel normally manages to down-regulate this inflammatory response, and how some of these things can be altered either by bacteria, genetics, medications, etc. And at the end of the day, I don't know that I love this category, because this is sort of the end result of what all of the rest of this is causing, is that you end up with this dysregulated immune response, you lose the tolerance that you should normally have, and you end up having, you know, altered activation or overly aggressive activation. So again, we talked about genetics. Genetics is interesting. It's known that about 5% of people with IBD will have a family member with IBD. You know, clearly the disease that runs in families. But what's interesting is, again, you have, you know, identical twins with ulcerative colitis. The concordance rate is about 5 to 15%. Crohn's disease, you know, up to 44 to 50%. So that's a big number, right? 50% risk factor, when we talk about that, you know, I mean, that clearly shows a genetic, you know, influence. But on the flip side, it means if you have an identical twin and you have Crohn's disease, it's only one in two that he's going to have it or she's going to have it. It clearly is more than just a specific genetic inheritance. There are clearly other factors that weigh into whether one goes on to develop inflammatory bowel disease. You know, in terms of some of the things that we talk about with the genetic influence, so it does run in families, but even the clinical patterns run in families. So again, fistulizing disease tends to run in families. Fibrostenotic disease tends to run in families. The inheritance seems to be that it's more than one gene, that it's a polygenic susceptibility. And in recent years, they've actually defined a number of mutations that seem to run in family, and this NOD2 mutation that tends to run on chromosome 16 is one that's more involved in fibrostenotic disease. So again, as we learn more about the genetics, there's still not really specific genetic testing, but there do seem to be more and more genetic arguments that even the different forms of Crohn's disease are probably indeed different entities as opposed to just one a spectrum of one disease. So again, what are some of the environmental things? So again, a lot of these things are things that alter the barrier. So again, antibiotics can clearly affect the normal antibiotic flora. Things in your diet, processed food, nitrates, etc., may have a role there. Smoking, we know, affects regeneration and repair of a lot of tissues and organ systems, and that can cause more problems with the mucosa. Medications, especially NSAIDs, can degrade that. Infection clearly can. So what you're basically talking about is something that overwhelms the normal capacity of the mucosa to deal with non-self. So, when one talks about how is it that we normally defend ourselves, the normal mucosal defense systems. So you normally have a mucosa, and between mucosal cells you have a tight junction which limits size of particles and amount that can get through. You have regenerative, you have repair mechanisms. So just again, as a barrier function, you have goblet cells in the colonic mucosa that secrete a mucus, which gives you a bit of a barrier, and also the substance called intestinal trefoil factor, which is involved in repair once there's injury. You have other things such as secretory IgA and some of the other factors that involve restitution and repair, normal blood flow in terms of getting proper inflammatory cells and cytokines to the region are also part of the process that helps with normal regeneration and repair. And so in an ideal world, under normal circumstances, you're ingesting food, you may be exposed to a bacteria, whatever it is. There are these areas called M cells, which are areas where the tight junctions are not as tight. Usually where in the submucosa you have Peyer's patches or lymphoid aggregates or areas that are more prepared to deal with the foreign antigen. This is the preferred area of uptake in the normal situation, and this tends to lead down towards activating these naive T cells towards a pattern of downregulation suppression. And usually the cytokines that are involved in that are IL-10 and TGF-beta, which is not all that important. But the point that I'll make on the next slide is that when you start this process, you basically have a T cell that can be activated along several pathways. And in the quote-unquote normal host, the pattern that is preferred is this one where you get the inhibition or lack of activation of the mucosal immune system that leads to this downregulation and this concept of tolerance. Whereas if you go along some of these other pathways, you're more likely to get a more aggressive active inflammation that can get triggered in a number of ways. And it's not hard to imagine that a lot of things can play into this leaky mucosal barrier. Right, so there can be genetic influences that make your tight junctions not as tight, or your mucus not as viscous, or your repair mechanisms not as intact based on those causes. You can certainly envision that, again, an infection or a medication or something can cause denudation of mucosa and can lead you down this path. And so what ultimately happens in people with inflammatory bowel disease is that they end up getting bombarded through their mucosal immune system along a pro-inflammatory mechanism, which leads to this loss of tolerance and what I refer to as the inappropriate activation or the immune dysregulation. So again, this is really more effect than cause, but the cytokines that get activated in the setting of this loss of tolerance are really more TNF, IL-12, which are these pro-inflammatory cytokines, as opposed to, I mentioned before, IL-10 and TGF-beta, which are the classic cytokines that we see in the anti-inflammatory response. And actually, I'll point out TNF because I won't have time to talk about therapy. So although it's one of several cytokines, it clearly is one that has a potent pro-inflammatory response, which is why a lot of the current medications that we see in inflammatory bowel disease, also in some of the rheumatoid arthritis and some of the other rheumatologic diseases, target TNF as a factor. And this is more experimental models, and it took us a long time to come up with animal models for inflammatory bowel disease, but about 10, 15 years ago, some of those models were finally identified. But so if you do this all in a vacuum and there are no bacteria present, and someone who has everything else as a requirement for colitis, you get no colitis, no immune activation. But just by populating a normal enteric flora, basically, in a susceptible patient, you can model and cause a colitis in that setting. So, you know, it's clear that there is a role of bacteria, but it's probably just the normal flora as opposed to anything else. And again, and these are just some examples of those bacteria that may exist at different environments that may explain some of this north-south gradient of why things like lactobacillus, that we know is a common ingredient in a lot of the probiotics, may actually be somewhat protective or anti-inflammatory as opposed to some of the other more aggressive commensal organisms. And I mean, I'll stay around for a few minutes if anyone wants to talk about, you know, therapy in a general sense or a specific sense, but I'll stop there. Okay. Thank you.
Could affect.
Do they
No, these are not.